The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening in. My guest this week is Tom Whipple, a former U.S. Intel analyst who has put out the peak oil news for more than a decade. His newsletter is now associated with the Post Carbon Institute and can be found at peak-oil.org. Tom's not exactly a tinfoil hat kind of guy, but we get into a discussion in the heart of this interview about exotic alt energy matters, including new developments in fusion and cold fusion, and I will leave it to you to draw your own conclusions about that. I disagree with Tom about the role that electric cars might play in the years ahead, but we didn't exactly have a debate about it during this chat, which I believe you will otherwise find very interesting. So kick back and listen to Tom Whipple. The sponsor for this podcast is David McIlvaney's ICA Financial Group. You need to own physical precious metals in your portfolio, whether in your possession, in an IRA, or stored internationally. It's imperative that you work with a company that advises you on and manages your gold and silver. ICA has been an industry leader since 1972. Your ICA advisor will get you set up correctly and keep you informed about when to make a move, when to add ounces, and even assist you with an exit strategy as markets change. So call 1-800-525-9556 for a free portfolio review. That's 800-525-9556 for the McIlvaney ICA Financial Group. Or go to icagoldcompany.com to request information. And now here's my conversation with Tom Whipple of the Peak Oil News. First of all, I'm curious about how you, Tom Whipple, got into the energy analysis business. You run a website and have been doing it for quite a while that a lot of people rely on for energy information. How'd you get into this line of work?
Well, right after 2000, I started reading about the people who started talking about peak oil. But I think I may have stumbled about it by looking at electric cars and that sort of thing, eventually stumbled over to peak oil. And I got into it deeper and deeper, and I decided these guys had something there. The people, you know, the guys, the European geologists who sort of founded the whole concept, they had held a couple of meetings. They started their own, you know, World Association, ASPO International. They held a couple of conferences over the seas. And I read through this thing, and I just couldn't see where they were wrong. And I think I realized the implications of this thing. You know, it's not going to be run out, but start run short and get much, much more expensive oil.
A lot of people think peak oil is dead, that it's an idea that it has gone away. I would say that the storyline has only shifted a little bit, and we're going to talk about that. But can you tell listeners whether you think peak oil is dead?
No, it's alive and well, and there's more evidence every day how well it's doing. And my bottom line, it's been delayed for about 10 years. We were talking about 2014 as, you know, when we would start to see, you know, real troubles, i.e. much higher prices and possible leveling off of world production. And now it looks like in the early 20s sometime, probably about, you know, anywhere from 20 to 24.
That 10-year delay seems to have been due to the so-called shale oil miracle.
That's all it was.
And shale oil appears to have been a kind of a grand stunt brought on by the zero interest rate regime and the central bank money creation, which made a huge amount of capital available for an enterprise that seems to only lose money.
You've got it. You've got it exactly right. Well, first of all, the price of oil went way up. You know, started, went up from, you know, $20, $30, $40 a barrel up to $140 there, I guess, at the peak. There was plenty of money available at this point. The people had known about fracking, you know, much further back, but didn't look like it afford it. was just too darn expensive.
Yeah.
They started poking around with fracking more, and they got better at it. They got the laterals longer. They got better sand in there, that sort of thing. They got better ideas. And start producing quite a bit of, you know, what we call oil. It's extremely light oil. It's much closer to gasoline than we'd like to think.
And what I understand about the problem with that is that it doesn't contain the grades of oil that produce a lot of diesel and aviation fuel and other things that the world really needs badly.
Exactly. You've got it exactly right. The biggest problem with it right now, in the last week or so, I guess you're aware that I probably look at 300 or 400 articles about this every week.
Sure.
I probably select 40 or 50 a day, and I read them all before the end of the week because I already have a pretty good idea what's going on. Many people have started to comment that you can't refine this stuff in the U.S. anymore. U.S. refineries are set up to do heavier grades of oil. There are only a very few refineries that want the stuff, and much of it is going to have to be exported. It's not going to be much use to us in the U.S. here anymore. We're still importing the heavier stuff. And exactly right, the different grades of oil. This is basically can make gasoline, petrochemicals, that sort of thing. It's very good as dilutant. You can take very heavy oil and mix some of the stuff with it and get out something you can refine or at least run through a pipe. But just straight shale oil is, you know, very, very high API numbers and this sort of thing. And you saw when these tank cars and this stuff turn over, they blow up like gasoline does. We had a case of that up in Quebec a few years ago. They blew the whole town apart. The train load of shale blew up. This is not the panacea for anything. Bottom line is, granted, you're going to have another couple of years of an awful lot of rapid, you know, growth in shale oil production. EIA is talking another million barrels. We're going to go up from just past 10 million barrels in U.S. production, of which about 5 or 6 was shale oil. They're talking about another million barrels increase during 2018, and that could happen.
And this must be very confusing to the public.
It is. This is why the whole concept of peak oil is totally lost. The major problem we see in this sort of thing is that in our federal government, Department of Energy, Energy Information Administration, is projecting that this is going to continue until 2050. So continue for another 30 years, and a lot of people think, outside people who are not, you know, wrapped up in the industry, not wrapped up in finance, not wrapped up in the future of the stock market, are saying this is totally nuts. There's not enough oil there to do this sort of thing.
Well, just looking at the chart, they put out charts recently to kind of celebrate the new American oil peak, which finally surpassed the 1970 peak of just under 10 million barrels a day. And what the chart shows is it took something like 90 years to get to that original peak. And this new secondary peak, it's taken like since 2007. To get up there. The inference I would make is that that's a very steep kind of, what do you call it, a logarithmic rise. Mm-hmm. I would infer that the fall would be equally steep.
Well, first thing to remember about shale oil, a shale oil well will decline 70% to 90% in its first 3 years. Basically, after 3 years, it's gone. Everybody's familiar with the nodding donkeys, the jack pumps that pump oil, the little bits out of the bottom of wells that get. You can't use these on shale oil wells. It doesn't work. These things go sideways. You can't pump it out.
So yeah, this, I understand that the pipes frequently break because of that elbow going from the vertical to the horizontal frack line.
You just can't stick a rod down there and start pulling oil up. Nothing collects at the bottom of the going down pipe. So they just don't do this. Therefore, in 3 years, any well you drill will be gone. Now, there's a new publication, and I guess you're aware I'm a member of the Post Carbon Institute, and I'm one of their fellows. And one of my co-fellows there is a fellow named Dave Hughes, who used to be the chief geologist for the Canadian government, I think. And he just wrote a new study I would recognize to anybody interested in this called Shale Oil Reality Check. It's free. You can download it. You know, just Google on the web, shale oil reality check. And he just went through sort of well by well across the United States and said this projection, they were going to be able to maintain, you know, 12 million barrels a day, you know, for the next 20 or 30 years is just totally nuts. For example, to do this, it would require the drilling of 1.3 million new wells in that time. This would cost $7.7 trillion. To drill these wells. That sort of money isn't there. And then number two, the oil is probably not there to drill 129 million wells worth of oil. two people that I respect highly that watch Dave Hughesby every couple year or so. He goes through and reanalyzes again. And Art Berman down in Texas. You know, Art, he makes his living evaluating oil wells for people. And he published something recently that said this. I guess everybody's aware of this, all now focused on the Permian Basin. There's three big basins in the United States that are left. They're producing lots of oil. Bakken up in North Dakota, Eagle Ford down in South Texas, and the Permian Basin, which has been there for 100 years. It's a very old basin. Within they learned how to frack it. Art Berman went through all the official filings of these companies, all they have to file the government every year what they have, how much oil they have. And these guys say there's only about 3 billion barrels of oil that they currently are aware of, have currently found and proved in the Permian Basin. 3 billion barrels isn't very much. The people who are hyping this are talking about 30 billion.
Yeah, we use about somewhere between 5 and 7 billion barrels a year. Seven, yes. If you include the natural gas distillates and stuff.
And the whole world is going through about 36 billion barrels a year now. Now, if you look at the whole peak oil story, my favorite statistic of this thing right now is last year we only found 4 billion barrels of new oil all over the world.
And that's a record low after previous record low years of
totally
discovery.
Record lows in this thing. It's just like your bank account. If you're going to take 36,000 out every year and only put 4 in, it's not going to last very long. And so far, there's very little indication that the oil companies are going to, you know, dramatically increase exploration for this stuff. Yes, they are finding some new oil. But keep in mind that the conventional oil, which is probably about 80% of the oil we're getting at now, is still depleting at about 6% a year, whether they like it or not. You can look 10 years from now, and there's not going to be much of the conventional oil left anymore. And the EIA is saying, well, this is all going to come from the Permian Basin. And the people who look at the Permian Basin carefully, you know, outside observers, no particular bias on this, and have the knowledge to how to look at these things. I certainly know the knowledge how to look at, you know, oil wells or oil fields, but there are some few people out there that do. And they say this is totally nuts. This is not going to happen. So the bottom line of this whole thing is that somewhere in the 20s, who can name it, you know, could be anywhere from the early 20s to the mid-20s, it looks like we're going to see a big run-up in oil prices again. That's the first clue that you've got a problem here. And then after that, we're going to start looking through production statistics, and they're going to start to flatten out. At some point, we're going to see the, you know, the traditional peak oil curve up there, where peaks looks like a peak and starts going down again. And remember, as shale oil makes a bigger and bigger percentage of this stuff, shale oil goes down very quickly. In 3 years, a shale oil well is essentially gone, and you can just write the thing off.
Art Berman made the point that the shale oil, the whole enterprise is a, quote, retirement party for the oil industry.
Well, this is probably a very good way of characterizing it.
He made the point, you know, the fact that American oil companies are not building new refineries actually sends a message. And that message is that the capital expenses involved could never be recouped, you know, inside of a 30-year lifespan of the refinery. And so they probably don't believe that the shale oil endeavor has a long lifespan.
That's why it's not worth spending the billions to convert these refineries to refine shale oil, the cheaper, lighter grades of oil, this sort of thing. And they're just shipping it out. So
yeah, it does raise an interesting question for me, kind of an existential question about the oil industry is, why are they bothering with this gigantic venture that just loses money? Is it because they're oil companies and they really have nothing else to do, so they have to stay in oil?
Remember, some people are making money. The guys that are drilling are making money. The guys that are drilling, driving the trucks out there are making money. They're getting paid.
Yeah, but they're subcontractors.
Remember, it takes 1,000 truckloads, you know, 18-wheelers worth of stuff to drill and frack a well. So it's an awful lot of guys are getting paid to drive trucks back and forth from some depot to the well. Mm-hmm. And those guys are making money. The guys running the companies are paying themselves pretty well. The people that are losing are those who are investing in this stuff. And I hope there's not too many pension funds investing in, you know, shale oil companies. You know, in the last couple of years, absolutely many billions have been lost. The last figure I saw, there's something like 230 billion in the hole now, the debt. Wow. And people are largely doing shale oil wells. This whole thing is, you know, no interest rates, cheap debt-driven cheap money, and that's what's doing this thing. If the cheap money dries up, well, it's going to be a lot harder to do this. I'm surprised that, you know, they're all losing money. Not all of them, but the bulk of them are losing money. Those who are making money have something else to do. Like when Chevron gets in there and does some well, Chevron's got enough money coming from somewhere else to pay for some losses in Shell Wesley. Mm-hmm. The bottom line of this thing, I think we could start looking at the term peak civilization coming now. Mm-hmm. Fairly soon. You know, within the next, you know, 5 years or so, unless we come up with a far cheaper source of energy.
Well, there's a lot of chatter about that, and a lot of it seems to be pretty idle chatter. I mean,
I'm not so sure. I've been looking at this very carefully for probably 6 or 7 years now. Mm-hmm. I follow all these things pretty carefully. Most of these things are way off the radar of the mainstream press. This is buried off of the corner of the internet somewhere. My feeling of this thing, unless there's some sort of breakthrough, you know, and probably fairly soon, say within the next 5 to 10 years, they can produce a new source of energy. This new source of energy must be a lot cheaper than anything we have now. It's got to be so cheap. You know, if you could start driving your car for it, you know, let's turn gasoline terms at 20 cents a gallon, that'd be the end of traditional oil. And that sort of thing. Sure. If your electricity could get down there to a tenth of a cent a kilowatt hour or something, very quickly this would happen. Now, the question is, can this happen in a hurry? Obviously, yes, somebody invents something right away. It's going to take decades to deploy it. The only thing recently that got spread pretty quickly was the cell phone. You know, that started in whatever it was, 86 or something. And 20 or 30 years later, practically everybody in the world's got one.
Of course, a cell phone is not an energy-producing device. It's just
there are
piece of hardware.
There are around that could, you know, have the potential of doing this thing. Not many people would pay much attention to it. For example, a simple one is a much better battery. As soon as you get much better and much cheaper batteries, and these are coming, the solar and wind becomes a much more effective source of energy. You know, it becomes a lot cheaper. And you can run it 24 hours a day, et cetera, et cetera. And this isn't disputed. I think the batteries are coming is not disputed. I would recommend any listener an outfit called a website called Green Car Congress. These guys sort of focus on the getting cleaner cars, but they discuss daily all the technological anything that they hear about, which is, you know, voluminous, that could, you know, make for cheaper cars, cheaper electricity. They publish, and I'm surprised. It's probably 3 or 4 times a week, a major lab somewhere in the world will announce, we have done something that will make the battery, you know, X percent better, 20% better, 30% better, 300% better. There's just an awful lot of this being produced, which is why I think we're going to have much better batteries, you know, batteries for electric cars pretty quickly, probably less than 5 years.
Tom, because this raises an interesting question, which is, even if we were able to do that, first of all, what's the benefit of continuing to be a car-dependent society?
My guess is it'd be so difficult to get out of a car-dependent society. There's got to be some transition. Maybe someday we can all take buses and whatnot, or, you know, hyperlink tunnels. But the idea of changing this very quickly, I think it's just absolutely nuts.
Well, that's one of the reasons I don't think it's going to work.
A lot of my colleagues in the post-carbon thing are basically focusing on, how do we get back to the 19th century? Let's get rid of internal combustion, and what would life look back in the 19th century? And they're sort of thinking, you know, life the way you are, you know, some rural place outside the town. Unfortunately, most of the world is living in massive cities, which are depending on, you know, massive amounts of diesel trucks to get the food they need and anything else they need in the city. You know, run the water, run everything else, run the electric and everything else. If this stuff goes down, obviously the world's going to be a lot of trouble, you know, pretty quickly, and you name it. And then on top of all this, we've got the whole damn climate problem, which is not going away. It's getting worse. And this is probably going to drive an awful lot of trouble anyway. If I could foresee mass movements of millions of people, you know, starting fairly soon, where wherever they're living just becomes totally uninhabitable, i.e. no food, no water.
Yeah.
So what do? You start walking. We're seeing this toward Europe already. Europe's already in turmoil. But all the people from the Middle East and Central Africa tried to make their way. The best thing Europe's got going is through the Mediterranean. Otherwise, they'd be at the fences trying to get their way in. A lot of them are making their way around through Greece and that sort of thing. Fortunately, they got the Russians there to stop them. But we've seen it here in the United States. What, we've had about 10 million people in order to make their way across the U.S. border in the last 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. And that's just because life here is habitable, it's livable. If you want to keep living, you turn north and walk. And we're going to see this. We're going to see all this around the world. There's no question about it.
Oh, well, so we're already seeing these rather substantial demographic movements for the reasons that you've mentioned. Sure. But getting back to the point you made a few minutes ago about peak civilization, it sounds like by bringing that up, you're rather dubious about some miraculous, unseen new energy source.
Unless some new energy sources. Well, I haven't started to talk about these things yet, but let me mention a few here. The most obvious is a better battery. That's not a source, but it's a way to get better use of solar and wind and that sort of thing. You put your solar panel in your house, run your whole house with a nice big battery in the back, sitting outside, that sort of thing. But there are several technologies out there which I have been following, I have been writing about. They're not totally absurd, let's say that. Remember the cold fusion business from 30 years ago, 1989, all that fuss got up.
Used to say that it was the energy of the future and always will be.
Well, that's hot fusion. That's hot fusion. It's 50 years away and always will be. And believe it or not, there are quite a few people back on the hot fusion business again. The big government projects don't seem to be going anywhere. Every time they build one of these things, they spend umpty a billion on it. Like the National Ignition Facility out in California, that was to shoot a lot of laser beams at a pan of hydrogen or something. That didn't work. We've got this big inner thing in outside of Geneva now, and they've spent, at least the U.S. is only putting part of the money into this thing. It's not a total U.S. thing. The whole world's working, I think.
That's the Hydron Accelerator?
Yes, that's the accelerator, the inner thing, the thermonuclear accelerator. It's a compression thing is what it is. Mm-hmm. It's basically all these things pinch hydrogen to multiple hundred degrees. But in recent years, there's three or four smaller ones of these things where people are working. There's one in California, and some people seem to be money for these things. Again, these things are all a decade away. I think what we're going to look at is there something closer? Well, first of all, we've got the cold fusion business. That was simply loading hydrogen into a metal and getting heat out of it. It was announced by Pons and Fleischmann, University of Utah, 1989. It made a big flurry, front page of all the magazines for a couple of weeks. The scientists of the world tried to reproduce it. They couldn't. They said it was a total fraud. We now know 30 years later, the reason they couldn't produce it was a lot harder to reproduce. And these two guys were just lucky. This had the right mixture.
Well, is it hard to do under any circumstances?
Not anymore. There are at least two companies out there that are talking about commercializing this stuff this year.
Because I remember, 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I wrote The Long Emergency, people were talking about fuel cells and hydrogen, and the ideas about that have completely floated away.
That's all dried up. Yeah. But keep an eye on this fusion. There's two outfits. There's a guy in Florida named Rossi who is demonstrating this stuff at the lab bench. Now, people don't believe lab bench-sized demonstrations. They just don't. It's too small. So you warm up a cup of water. Whoopee. That won't do it. There's another outfit called Brillouin out in California, and they're making some good progress, too. Rossi says he will have a commercial product on the market this year, next year. These guys always get over shills. My favorite, however, is a guy up in New Jersey. I know him. I've been up through his labs. It's called Brilliant Light Power. This guy has had zero publicity simply because the world of science doesn't believe it. If he's right, he has moved beyond our understanding of, at least chemistry on this sort of thing. And he gets a lot of flack for it. Well, first of all, these are not small operations. He's raised well over $100 million. His annual budget's about $5 million. He's got a pretty big lab up there full of lots of guys in white coats running around, working this stuff. He occasionally puts on a public demonstration. I've been to a couple of them. I've been through his lab. And he, as far as I can see, has invented a new source of energy. The problem is getting this thing off the lab bench and coming up with something that could be useful, light up a football stadium or something or other.
Do you have any idea what it consists of?
Yes. I go into much depth on it if you want to, but I think it's probably too much for this thing. But basically, he's a very interesting guy, by the way. This guy is extremely bright. You're probably looking at an Einstein-level IQ. if this thing comes through. Mm-hmm. You see what he's done. His academic background reflects the same thing. What he has done is he has discovered that hydrogen can exist in a compressed state. Quantum physics says this is impossible. This is what the main fuss is all about, why nobody believes them. If you teach quantum mechanics, you don't want to hear this. You don't believe it, you don't want to hear it, you won't even look at it. You just sit there and scream until the idea goes away. But what he has found is a way to take hydrogen, and which we're well aware is probably the cheapest fuel around. We've got oceans of the stuff. And by applying a current to it in the right environment, can lower the orbit of the electron around the proton and release a lot of energy. As simple as that. He's been working on this thing for 25 years. About 6 or 7 years ago, he came up with the formula, and since then has made fairly good progress toward commercializing this thing. He's got reactors in the lab that will run continuously. What it does, it makes a plasma about the size of a teacup that can produce hundreds of thousands of kilowatts of energy of this thing. The energy comes out in the form of light. There's a question of how you convert from light into electricity, but there's several ways of doing that. And he is hoping to have something ready for public testing, by last year. So far, it's been more trouble. The problem is automating this device. You got something in a lab bench with five guys standing around in white coats, tweaking with knobs and levers and that sort of thing. It'll keep running. The problem is turning this thing into something you can put in your basement.
Yeah, it also, for me, raises the question of, like a lot of other procedures of this sort, whether you're putting in more energy into the procedure than you get out.
In this case, you're not. So much
well,
comes
that's
out.
A claim.
What goes in is trivia. Okay. And this sort of thing. If you understand the problem. Okay, this guy is totally online. He is totally open. 99.9% of what he's doing is on his website. Mm-hmm. Go take a look at it. Go look at his demos, his talks. It's published there. He's got a 1,500-page theory of how this works. Unfortunately, it's all in very dense mathematics. And my calculus doesn't begin to approach this stuff. You're going to be way out to understand what he's talking about in the math of this thing. But it's all out there. The whole theory is out there. Mm-hmm. So he's one guy. He's my favorite. He's had this out and out trying to get this thing automated so he can, leave it untouched by human hands. He's got lots of money. Wall Street and, believe it or not, the electric power companies have been bankrolling him for many years now. And if he can come through with this thing, you can doubt if you want, but go take a look at his website. Either he's going to come or he's not going to come. Simple as that. If he comes, something like this does have the potential to change the world. Remember, things do get invented occasionally.
Sure.
Such as the internal combustion engine, which changed an awful lot of things. It's pretty the atmosphere, but it certainly changed an awful lot of things and that sort of thing. Steam engine.
It didn't come out of a vacuum. It was invented because, 50 years earlier, America started producing large volumes of oil.
Sure,
and,
exactly.
We understood that you could get a controlled explosion in a metal box called an engine and run a car.
Once internal combustion came, you name it, ships, steamships, cars, motel, the whole bit, everything changed after that. His compressed hydrogen, which he calls Hydrino, is capable of, go take a look at his website, it's worth doing.
Sure, okay.
There's a couple other people out there that you can laugh if you want, but as far as I can see, enough people have tested this stuff to say it works. There's something called kinetic thrust, in which you use buoyancy of water to make electricity. The outfit called KPP in Germany have got this going. MIT just announced the other day they've got a gadget on the roof that's making electricity from the differential in air temperatures. If the air temperature moves from one temperature to another, they can use that to make energy, not very much. Then you've got the whole biofuel business that Shell announced the other day. I follow this stuff, that they think they're on the verge of some big breakthrough in biofuels whereby they can, grow algae and use this as energy. So basically what I'm saying here is that there are some exotics out there. I don't think they're totally far-fetched. If these come in the next, 5 years or so, and, people accept them, they're there, the thing they have going for them is they will be able to produce energy at a much, much cheaper thing. For example, Mills has done the arithmetic. He thinks he can produce energy at a tenth of a cent a kilowatt hour. Right now, the U.S. is paying about 10 cents a kilowatt hour.
Is that the brilliant light power guy?
Yeah, he's got much discussion there how his gadget will produce it at 10%. The fuel for this thing, believe it or not, is nothing but water extracted from the atmosphere. That's mm-hmm. the only fuel. Essentially zero cost of fuel. So all you have is the cost of the gadget. And these things, you're looking, depends on the size of the gadget, what you're trying to do, you're looking in low thousands to make these things.
Yeah, as a kind of, you know, amateur, I only play a science guy on TV, but it raises a couple of questions. You know, one is things that sound too good to be true usually are.
That's why nobody's accepting this right now. About 20 years ago, there was a website fighting what Mills had to say and the scientists had to say, and finally they just agreed to a draw, and basically, Mills and the cold fusion guy, Rossi, are going to do a Wright brother. The only way they're going to convince anybody that this thing will work is get a demonstration-sized thing actually running, you know, turned on. The Wright brothers got it, turned it on, got in it, and flew over town and flew back and forth over Ohio. And everybody said, oh, my God, people can fly. It was all over in a matter of seconds. These guys are going to have to do the same thing. Nobody will believe the science, the calculations, the lab experiments, the things blowing away at the lab. They don't want to believe it. It's only going to work when, as one of my colleagues of this thing says, Mills is going to have to take this thing over to a baseball stadium, put it on the pitcher's mound, and light the whole damn stadium up. At that point, the argument is over. We can start getting on with something silly. Is this going to happen soon or not? I simply don't know.
Yeah, I guess the other question is, does it scale? You know, something that's a science project can be done on the level of a science project might not scale.
Until recently, Mills was saying, okay, he was coming up with a gadget that would produce 400 or 500 kilowatts. Enough to easily run a house, easily run a building. A couple of these office buildings, put them on top roof of Walmarts and run the Walmart, run the shopping mall, anything you want to do, that these things will be totally distributed. You don't need the electric grid anymore. The grid can go. You know, again, it's going to take decades to happen. But if you can get rid of the grid, you know, all sorts of wonderful things happen. For example, you can't get knocked over in a snowstorm, that sort of thing, you know, within your basement. And these things are cheap enough to be redundant. If you're looking at something that costs $20,000, you know, you put a dozen of these things in a building. Or the backyard or the roof or somewhere or other. Actually, they make so much excess heat, you got to put them out somewhere where they rent the heat. But he's had a lot to say. I would highly recommend you take a look at him.
Sure.
If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't happen in our lifetime, well, it didn't happen in our lifetime. He's got the thing working in the labs, all I can say. He's got this, you know, this plasma glowing at whatever, 600,000 centigrade. As far as I can see, the world is not moving fast enough. There was a piece in MIT put out a couple days ago that said somebody did the arithmetic and said at the rate we're replacing fossil fuels with nuclear energy and renewables, it's going to take 400 years to get rid of all the fossil fuels. And anybody looking at climate change is going to say, we sure don't have 400 years.
Well, anybody looking at fossil fuels would also say we don't have 400 years of that either.
Exactly. You know, at best, you know, 40 or 50 on coal, and probably on the oil. Even the most optimistic aren't talking much beyond, you know. Everybody says peak oil is going to come by 2040 or 50. I'm not going to live that long, but everybody says by 20 or 40 or 50 we're going to have it. That sort of thing.
Well, other people like maybe you and me would argue that it's going to be sooner.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm arguing now. It's looking like this could show up within the next five.
Now, Gail Tverberg is a woman who has been on the scene commenting about oil issues for about the last 10 or 15 years.
I know Gail quite well.
Okay, and she was on the Oil Drum website that shut down eventually.
Yeah.
And she was one of the main editors there, and now she's got her own website called Our Finite World. I've had her on the podcast. Her view is that even if the oil industry becomes distressed one way or another, either, you know, not being able to produce enough supply or not being able to come up with the capital necessary to invest in new operations, you know, her view has been that the price of oil is actually liable to stay low rather than go up. I wonder what you think about her thesis, which has been pretty consistent with her for, you know, the last several years.
It just gets back supply and demand again. If the price goes up, as we saw back in 2008, when the gasoline got up to four, average in the U.S. was about $4 something a dollar of gasoline, the demand just dropped way off. People found ways to not, discretionary driving just did not take place.
Well, and it also seemed to have done a lot of damage to the economy itself.
It damaged the economy badly. I just don't think the 2008 recession, enough credit has ever been given to the high price of oil. People sort of got totally wrapped up in the housing debacle, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And nobody spent too much attention on the $140 barrel oil we had there for a couple of weeks, sure, which basically created a lot of things. Everything, as you know as well as I do, everything depends on oil. There's 10 calories of oil in every calorie we eat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. If the cost of oil doubles or triples, we're just not going to use it. So therefore, the price may or may not go up. I think you'll see a lot quicker move for electric cars and that sort of thing. People don't like them now. They're slightly inconvenient. You have to plug them in a lot. You can't go where you want. There's not a gas station every corner, but they work fine. They work quite well. I hate to admit it, but I'm driving one now myself, that sort of thing.
Is it an all-electric or is it a hybrid?
No. I'm driving a new Prius Prime. I guess it's 25 miles, which is fine for my purposes.
Say that again. How many miles range?
Well, there's two cars out now. This year's Prius will give you 25 miles all electric.
25?
25, yeah.
That's pretty short
for
range.
For my purposes, they're fine around town.
Okay.
And so they just run back and plug it in at home, and 2 hours later, it's back for another 25. And then if you want a long trip, you take the car. Honda just brought one out with 50, a 50-mile battery in it. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. It's a hybrid with a 50-mile battery in it. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite on the market yet, but they've advertised it already, and they should have it this year, next year.
Well, one question that I would have is, with the continuing impoverishment of the middle class in America, they seem to be less able to buy any kind of a car, whether it's an internal combustion engine or an electric car, the way that Americans are used to buying cars, which is on installment loans, and they don't qualify for the loans, and the terms of the loans are becoming more extreme. And
that's why it may be very difficult to make this transition for cars. We may not keep, we have 110 million cars in the U.S. right now. It's about 1 billion worldwide. Here's the thing about cars, they all sort of poop out in 10 or 15 years at the most. They don't last much beyond that.
Well, the theory is that electric cars have so many fewer moving parts that the life of the cars would probably be
extended. The car should go on for decades.
But that would raise the question of whether these companies can put out a product that never breaks and has to be replaced. And I wonder about the whole automobile matrix, actually. And it seems to me that Americans would probably be even happier and do better and live better lives if they were in walkable towns.
Yes. That's true too, but again, this takes decades to fade. If we set out to do that right now, there's no indication we're setting out to doing that. It's going to take decades for this to happen.
Well, sure, but what if
so many people out there in suburbia now, 20 miles from anywhere, 50 miles from anywhere, totally dependent on their cars?
Yeah, but just because they're there, what if circumstances compel them to make changes?
Probably the first thing is to be electric. They could probably get a whole class of cheap electric cars. These things are floating around now. Electric mopeds, electric golf carty thing. They improve on golf carts, that sort of thing. Uh-huh. These could be an awful lot cheap. You don't need to be drive around a Mercedes with all that comfort and all the gadgets there. Sure. If you just need to get there, a golf cart will get you there 20 miles an hour. And it's clear we have much better batteries. These things will go hundreds of miles, mm-hmm, 5 years from now. There's no question about that. And the batteries will be a lot cheaper. That's the one thing. I think if you get the cost of the batteries down, electric cars could be, cheap electric cars could be pretty cheap.
Well, let's get back to oil for a minute.
Sure. Okay, sure.
I want to talk about the Permian Basin. Let's talk about them all. There seems to be some indication that of the three main shale oil basins, that the Bakken and the Eagle Ford have peaked and are on their way into a steep decline.
That's probably true. Both of these are, production there is confined almost totally to sweet spots, which are about 10 to 15% of the places where they can get oil out. Anywhere else, you're just not getting it out. First point on the whole shale oil business is it now looks like we've had enough years of experience that all this so-called new technology that's come along since 2016, which is mostly longer laterals. They go down and drill further out. They drill out half a mile or a mile when they go sideways, putting a lot more water in it, putting a lot more sand in it. They divide up into more sections. And of course, they cost a lot more to do that.
Sure.
So this sort of thing. But it now looks like doing these things initially gets out more oil. For the next first couple of months, more oil comes out. However, it drops off faster. At the end of 3 years, you're going to have to spend your $7 million, whatever you spent on the well, and you're not going to get any more oil out of it, you know, by putting in more sand and more water, but it's cost you more.
Well, it's like the old trick. The guy who wants to make his blanket longer cuts a foot off the top and sews it under the bottom.
You got it. It's exactly what they're doing. They're getting the oil out faster. In the first 3 months, wow, production of this well is, you know, the average well that we're drilling, you know, this year is producing a lot more in the first 3 months than it did three years ago.
Is that a gag to demonstrate to the Wall Street investors that it's a great place to put your money?
The relationship of all the shale oil drillers in Wall Street is just, you know, totally bizarre. 2 or 3 years of, you know, lower prices. Obviously, Wall Street got very nervous. All these guys were going bankrupt left and right. They were losing their billions that they put in this thing. And they start insisting that, you know, instead of growing their business so fast, they start trying to grow their profits and giving somebody back a little bit of money on this stuff rather than just totally losing money. This is the mantra right now. Everybody, I guess all these guys sworn a stack of Bibles that they were going to try to make a profit. And right now, it doesn't seem like they're doing it. We're going to have to wait a year or so and see what the returns are. And this boom that's going on now, it looks like everybody's trying to expand as fast as they can. But the question is, yes, everything seems to be pretty well gone, but the Permian Basin, even the EIA is saying the bulk, you know, 80 or 90% of the growth will come out of the Permian Basin. So you're looking at one oil basin for basically the future of the U.S. oil industry and for the world. And this is, as Dave Hughes, the reality check, says, this just is not going to happen. It's just totally nuts. They can't drill a million oil wells in that one little place down there. It's just an absurd amount. There's no 7 trillion. You've seen the other day the Saudis keep talking about this. They're about some sense. They say the world has got to invest $20 trillion, with a T, dollars, in the next, you know, N number of decades, 2 or 3 decades, to keep oil production going. I don't see anybody's got $20 trillion. That's the whole U.S. deficit now, for God's sake.
Yeah, well, not only that, but we're capital formation is now so impaired.
Yes.
That there's every reason to believe that there's simply going to be a whole lot less capital, that we're going to be in a capital scarcity situation.
Some of the problem with the big international oil companies, they all got dependent on paying out a steady dividend. They've been doing it for 50 years or something, you know, Exxon, Shell, BP, and that sort of thing. Everybody, all the widows and orphans are dependent on the Shell dividend. And along comes a decline in oil prices from 100 to 40 or whatever it got to down there. Obviously, their profits disappeared, and they didn't feel they could cut their dividends, which they should have. You know, in a pure capitalist environment, if your income goes down two-thirds, your dividends should go down two-thirds, but they tried their best to maintain their dividends. And what gave? What gave was exploring for new oil. You couldn't stop paying dividends. You weren't making the money. What can you stop doing? Well, I can stop, you know, spending billions and billions, or I can reduce it. Nobody stopped it. They reduced it by two-thirds on looking for new oil wells, you know, especially this deep sea stuff, which has been tremendously expensive on this sort of thing. There's still, the numbers I keep seeing is $80 or $90 a barrel to get deep sea well out, where you go down, you know, through 5,000 feet of water and then start drilling. And yes, there's oil down there, but who's got the capital to do this? The oil companies still don't. If they're making $100 a barrel, they probably could. You know, they probably have some left over to invest in $80 or $90 a barrel oil. Now, the oil companies, this is the deep sea stuff, which is really where the bulk of the world's oil is going to come from in the future. It's not going to be shale oil. It's going to be deep water oil. They say, well, okay, the newest thing is that every one of these things was a custom design thing, and it cost billions. You know, Thunder Horse and the rest of these things we have.
You mean the platforms?
Cost billions and take 5 or 6 years to do. What they're trying to do now is come up with a standard platform, you know, sort of like a Ford F-150 or something. All oil platforms will look the same. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we can get great economies of scale. We'll build 10 or 20 of these things at once. Every oil platform and everything we do will be exactly the same in any location.
Well, it's a nice idea, but it begs the question, why did they have to be custom-built in the first place? There's probably some reason for it.
Well, that's because I guess they're just one up one at a time, and somebody went and bid for the part, saw it, and designed it, and that sort of thing. But it had to do with depth. The deep water is all fairly new technology. You only look in the last 10 years or so, 15 years, they start going, you know, not these little offshore things, which just sort of, you know, short legs, the things they put way, they had to float, i.e. they're too long to put legs on the floor.
Sure.
That'd be floating and held into place. And that's all fairly new technology.
In the time remaining, let's take a little tour of the globe. I want to ask you about, you know, what's going on in some other countries. China, for example, is a major importer and user of oil products, natural gas. They have relatively small reserves of their own.
Yeah.
Are they in a squeeze? Are they facing a squeeze?
They are in one of the biggest squeezes on the earth right now. That's why I suspect if somebody comes up with an alternative, these guys are going to jump on it. They're going to beat the rest of the world in implementing it because they can do it. China oil peaked, so basically it's been flat for a long time. It peaked a couple of years ago when the price of oil dropped from 100 and something to 40. They found, you know, a fair percentage of the oil wells they were pumping were no longer economic. They can import the stuff for $40 a barrel, and it was costing them 100 and something to drill it. Mm-hmm. So they had enough sense to produce it. So they simply stopped. They shut down a large percentage of the oil and just started importing more and more. They're the main driver of the Bulkmen. Then they had this climate business, which is, I don't know if you have you been to China lately?
No.
I was there a couple of years ago. The air is god awful. I came home with gotten more disease than you can imagine. My ears were plugged up, but everything else got to play. It's absolutely terrible. They're killing themselves with the rotten air. Absolutely killing. Not in the country. Tibet's okay, but up in the northeast industrial areas are totally killing themselves. They're quite interesting on this whole global coal business. They realize coal's doing it. Practically all the heating in all these cities, and that place is just dripping in cities. God, this place I never heard of got 5 million people living there now. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what they've done the last 20 years, and, you know, growth in cities and growing to be, they're only growing 15%, they're down 6% now. But basically, they're the most interesting case around now. Last winter, they said, okay, gang, we're going to clean up the oil. The trouble is, with dirty air, everybody dies. You know, the leadership dies, the Politburo dies, all the members of the Chinese Assembly die. You can't go out. Mm-hmm. Yes, you can live in some, you know, a few air-conditioned filtered offices, but those are few and far between. And their kids are being killed. Mm-hmm. So they're really on a kick to clean up their air. They don't care so much about the carbon emissions and the global climate change, et cetera, et cetera. They're more interested in cleaning up their old air. So the first thing they did is just ban coal in all their cities and they ran around wildly putting in gas pipes to all these buildings. And lo and behold, there wasn't enough gas. At the end of the year, when the winter came, they tried to turn the gas, there simply wasn't enough from import LNG and from their own things. They have now totally reorganized. About last week, they announced a total reorganization of the energy industry in China. They now have a central ministry of energy. They're supposed to be in charge of everything. And this is a way they can, you know, coordinate the movement from coal to natural gas better, or whatever else they want to do. Chinese, I guess you're well aware, are now building themselves about 20 million new cars a year.
Yes, the biggest car producers and consumption in the world.
And the most interesting thing is when you go down and buy a new car, you don't have a trade-in. You take your bicycle and park it out behind the house. Mm-hmm. So these are all new demands for oil. I don't know if you know the story about trying to register a car in the cities now, but it's totally hysterical. Mm-hmm. You know, you can no longer register a new car in Beijing, Shanghai, several of the big cities, this sort of thing. They've got waste control. Some places have a lottery. You throw your name in a hat, and they pick out 10,000 people a year that can buy a new car.
Oh, so they're rationing car ownership.
Rationing cars. The other way you ration cars is by a lottery, i.e., what are my bid? Mm-hmm. The last time I looked, the price of a new license plate was something like $30,000.
Yikes.
If you could go out and put in a bid for one, there's a price bid. If you want to pay $30,000 just to get the plate.
Well, they've been playing fast and loose with money creation there, probably worse than we have.
Yes.
So it's no wonder that there's a lot of money sloshing around.
But they're the most interesting case out there now. This is what a lot of the – I just saw a couple of days ago that they now are getting more oil being produced under Chinese auspices is being produced overseas and in China itself. The China National Overseas Oil Corporation, CNOOC, is now producing more oil somewhere else that is inside China.
Let's talk about Western Europe for a minute, especially their dependence on Russian natural gas. And I wonder what you make of this. Now, you came out of the U.S. intel community, did you not?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay. So what do you make of the fact that European nations, NATO, actually, with the United States, are playing games with Russia, you know, putting troops on their borders and bringing tanks to the borders and, you know, threatening them and making them uncomfortable. And yet Western Europe is utterly dependent on natural gas to heat their homes and run their electric plants from Russia. So
totally bizarre. Europe couldn't last, you know, 6 weeks, you know, without what's coming in from Russia. The bulk of their energy is, you know, natural gas coming in from Gazprom. You know, into Europe, they can't do much about it. Even the British, in the middle of this spy fuss, they're importing Russian liquefied natural gas.
Well, so have they gone crazy or what? I mean, what's going on there as an intel guy?
They can't do anything about it. They're stuck. The Russians don't want to stop. That's right. Remember, Russia's nothing but a great big oil station. They have nothing else produced there worthwhile. Weapon systems and oil is all they can do.
Export, for making money.
It's everything that earns them any money. The only thing they can sell at all. If they can grow their own food pretty well, that sort of thing. But everything the exports is, you know, gas, oil, money. You know, some timber goes out and that sort of thing. They get lots of forests there. But, you know, without the gas, they're in so far. That's why I'm intrigued about anything replacing fluid, because they're finished. There's nothing there. Europe's dependent on them. They're dependent. And we can have this fight with this going on underneath it. Neither side can afford to give it up. Now, the one thing the Russians have, of course, is China. The Chinese market is getting bigger and bigger and bigger for Russian oil and gas. They put several new big pipelines in there. The Chinese are putting up pipelines everywhere. They're putting pipelines into Central Asia now. There's a couple new ones opening. They've been delayed a long time, but just opening up now. They're going to try to get all the gas they can from Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, those places. The Chinese are going to say, hey, we'll pay for the pipe. We'll say, okay.
Sure.
We'll buy it from you.
Got all the steel in the world.
They got all the steel in the world. We'll pay for the pipe. We'll put the pipe in. The same thing with this stuff coming from Russia. The Russians can't afford all this. They're not doing too well. As you're aware, their economy just hasn't been growing in the last few years at all. And that sort of thing. And the Chinese come in and say, okay, we'll put the pipeline in. You guys will together. And we'll tell you when it gets to the border. The Chinese basically are paying for all this stuff. So basically, you could see the whole Russia turn around. Everything goes to China. If China keeps going, the Russians could just export everything they export to China and survive very nicely. I think this is in the back of their minds. The Chinese, I think the Chinese drive some very hard bargains. They never announce the prices. I think the Chinese get very good prices out of the Russians.
Let's quickly skip over to the Western Hemisphere. What about Mexico and Venezuela?
Well, Venezuela is the top of the problem list right now. They are very close to collapsing on this sort of thing.
And by that, we mean pretty complete collapse, including the oil industry.
Including the oil industry, total collapse of the oil industry. Somebody points out, however, that a base of their oil industry now are still foreign joint companies. Mostly Orinoco stuff out there. I've got foreign companies in there.
That's heavy oil, though, isn't it?
That's heavy oil. But this can be diluted with something else. The foreign companies are going to keep this going. They're away from all the troubles. The foreign companies are feeding their own employees and their workers, obviously. If you are from some European oil company in there, I think even Chevron's still in there. Chevron's going to feed it, make sure its people, clear the alcohol, and that sort of thing. So there is a certain base that could keep running unless everything totally breaks down. This is total turmoil. But it's dropping rapidly. They were up at about 3 million barrels now. They just went by 1.6. They're probably at 1.4 or 1.5 now. And they may be down a million by the end of the year, or unless the whole thing collapses. Everybody got looking for food. Everybody runs to the Colombia border. Colombia is just getting swamped with Venezuelans now. If you're rich, you go to Miami. If you're poor, you walk to Colombia or take a bus to Colombia. The basic thing is they got so rich in Venezuela, they don't grow their own food anymore. Everybody quit farming. Just imported it all.
Oh, dear.
This has happened over the last 20 or 30 years.
Now, what about Pemex in Mexico?
Well, that's interesting. Keep an eye on their election. The guy that's leading the election, right now is totally against non-state oil, against getting all these foreign companies in there. And he said he's going to reverse that. Mm-hmm. This will turn all back to Pemex again. Now, the only good news out of Mexico is that they're finding quite a bit of oil in these Caribbean oil fields. If somebody comes up with the billions or two it takes to drill the platforms, et cetera, and there could be a fair amount of work about that. But again, you're looking at, you know, 5 or 6 years from now before that happens. Mm-hmm. Nothing's going to come out of those things. The way those big platforms work, it's, you know, some of the delays sit 7 or 8 years, they have any troubles with them, but usually 5 or 6 years to get any oil out at all.
This is deep water in the Gulf?
The deep water in the Gulf, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the deep water, it takes that long to get all this, because they drill multiple holes.
Yeah.
You know, they go out there, they drill multiple wells and that sort of thing, go outside with lateral things. Then they flood them. They drill water insertion wells below it so they can pump water into it and push it up. They get it out pretty fast that way. But all this takes, you know, 5 years to get going to do.
And tremendous capital expenditure.
And billions of dollars. The Mexicans don't have this. The last couple of auctions have been done quite well in Mexico. Because the big international oil companies, you know, even the Chinese, the Russians, what they say, there's a lot of oil here. Because it's right next to the big American fields out there that we've got.
Uh-huh.
So these are just, you know, 20 miles down the road. There's obviously oil there. If they've done their surveys, they say it's just as good. Mm-hmm. The question is, who's going to do this? And will Mexico, you know, will there be a big political push on this thing? Because the guy is likely to be the next president. Is saying, I don't like all this liberalization. And remember the Constitution, 1938, said no foreigners have anything to do with our oil. Mm-hmm. Even in the Constitution, for God's sake. So they can't drill for it. They can't do it. They can't help. So it's all Pemex. They had one company, probably rather inefficient. Well, a couple of years ago, they broke the Constitution, changed everything, and said, let the foreigners in. That's the only way we'll get enough capital to get going on this sort of thing. We've got to let Exxon or Shell or BP or somebody, or the French or somebody in there, you know, put the capital and drill it. We'll just collect the money, our share of the money from it. Basically, the whole world is tightening up. They're tightening up. They're getting less oil out. Venezuela's getting less oil out. We are the only ones. The U.S. shale oil industry is the only thing that's growing rapidly. Russians are basically stagnant. They have great hopes of getting a lot of stuff out of the off the Arctic when all the ice melts up there, and there's no trouble doing it. They don't seem to have without Exxon, who just pulled out the other day. Exxon finally got the message that they're not supposed to do this under U.S. law.
Is that because of the sanctions?
Yeah, the sanctions, yes. Mm-hmm. Exxon has been dragging along there with some excuse or another for several years after the sanctions. They finally have totally pulled out. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're doing.
We're running up against our one-hour limit. Any quick parting thoughts about the energy situation for listeners?
I think the next 5 years should tell everything where we're going. As I said before, peak civilization, and the whole, you know, nature of human civilization starts to, you know, take a turn for the worse, or whether we can, you know, muddle through. We should know in 5 years. I think that's my bottom line.
Well, that's an interesting parting thought, and this has been a very interesting conversation. I'm so glad I was able to get you on the podcast. I'm certainly going to be checking back with you again. Tell people how they can get the Peak Oil News and what your website is and all that.
The Peak Oil News now comes under the Post Carbon Institute, PCI. I think the website is peak-oil.org, O-R-G.
And they can subscribe to that, right?
It's all free, yeah. We have a daily and a weekly.
Okay.
The daily is probably more than you want to know, but the weekly sort of summarizes what's happened the last week.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Tom Whipple, and we will ride again.
Thank you.